Dear listeners, welcome to the Data Frontiers podcast. I'm your host, Valentine Gandhi. In this podcast series, we will explore how new data technologies are being used to address some of the most pressing issues of our time, such as COVID-19, climate change, infrastructure issues, diplomacy, and education. In 2020, the UK government commissioned a study that was undertaken by NIDA's Digital Futures Hub for the Frontier Technologies Programme. This was done to review the digital data landscape and identify data technologies that had the highest potential for impact and use by the FCDO, as well as the wider international development community. This study was led by Matthew Shearing, and I was the technical lead for the study. The full study link is available in the description below. In these exciting podcast series, we will be taking a look at some of the recommendations raised in this report and will speak to thought leaders and practitioners at the front lines of implementing data technologies. And we sincerely hope our guests will inspire you to make better practical use of frontier technologies in your own work. So we look forward to having you listen in to our episode. I'm very happy to introduce Edward Anderson, who is joining us today from Dar es Salaam. He is the Senior Technology and Resilience Specialist for the World Bank, and his focus is on the nexus of urbanization and climate risk and leveraging emerging imaging and mobility technologies for greater resilience in African economies. This includes the African Drone Forum, a multi-country platform to accelerate the deployment of safe, equitable, and pro-poor autonomous services in rural urban settings. Other programs that he's involved in includes the Resilience Academy, which builds local skills and services in adopting satellite, Internet of Things, community feedback, and UAS monitoring technologies to address unplanned urbanization in Africa. Edward participates in the EU's Drones and Humanitarian Action Expert Working Group, and he holds a master's degree in both aerospace engineering and international economics, as well as international relations. Thank you, Edward. We're very happy to have you here with us in the studio. And as a start, I am specifically interested in noting that you have a unique combination of international economics and international relations and aerospace engineering. How important is this combo in dealing with the issue surrounding use of emerging data sources? You can give us some examples on how it has helped you having this interdisciplinary background.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, the background was a little bit fortuitous. I never imagined I'd be working with drones in the year 2020 when I originally studied aerospace engineering. So certainly it's helped me with the sort of insight and understanding of that sort of industry, and also with the jargon, if you like. So I'm able to speak the engineer's language and follow the trends. And very often, you know, when we talk about disruptive tech, we're talking about things that are occurring outside of your focus field. So I think having a multidisciplinary background where you're looking at urbanization and city planning, but you've also got expertise in what's happening with robotics and aviation, occasionally these things intersect, right? And that's where insights really happen. So I think that for me, it's been sort of fortuitous that there's a drone revolution happening that is relevant to my professional line of work. For a long time, it was just a hobby to keep track of. And it helps me, I think, speak sort of technical language with the engineers, but also translate that into economic policy and regulatory type dialogue, which we have with our government clients in Africa. So you sort of need to understand, I think, the culture and the mindset of these different communities to be able to translate really ideas from one camp to another.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think you're able to bring perspectives from a technologies point of view, as well as from the international economics and relations point of view. And that is, I think, essential in this field. Could you tell us more about the work World Bank and more specifically your unit is doing with FCDO Tanzania in mapping flood risk areas in urban areas? And what technologies do you use? What data sources do you use?
Yeah, so I mean, for World Bank, disaster risk reduction is a core competence and a sort of central pillar of our development approach and advocating for preventative risk management. And in cities in Africa, we have this particular challenge that we're experiencing some of the fastest unplanned urbanization in history. So for us, it's really a challenge of managing for increasing complexity. You have growth of cities that is about 70 to 80% informal. And this is across the board in sub-Saharan Africa. It's not only Dar es Salaam, but Dar es Salaam is one of the largest cities that is growing at breakneck speed. And what that really means is that many parts of the peri-urban area, sometimes they're growing at 10 or 20%, which means that these sort of peripheries of the city are doubling the number of plots and houses and citizens every 4 years. So there's a basic challenge in how do you keep up with the sort of core functions of urban governance, town planning, demarcation of plots, issuing of titles, planning and provision of services. And then you add on that the added complexity of trying to fathom the impacts of the changing environment on your natural hazards. So the river flows are changing as a result of urbanization, with deforestation, with increased erosion. And then you layer on top of that changing weather as well. You're getting quite a dynamic picture that is accelerating as the growth is really taking off, and traditional tools and methods are just not scaling at the same rate to keep up with that. So the way we see it is it's a challenge of how to embrace this increasing complexity that demands a sort of holistic view, multi-sector coordination. So it's not purely a techno-scientific problem, although there is certainly elements of that in terms of climate hazards, but it's also that socio-economic and governance model to get it right. So the business case of the FCDO recognized really that the lack of data was a primary constraint on the municipal government's ability to manage essentially things they're not measuring, to get ahead of the problem and start to be proactive about risk rather than reacting to these flood events once the situation's already built up. And in doing that, I think they also recognize a need to be more innovative and creative in how are we going to digitize the city, how are we going to get this data, share it, understand it, and make it actionable. So I think there's sort of at the heart of this program a necessity to innovate, not because it's fun, but because the business as usual approach is really struggling to work and won't scale to meet the challenge.
Thanks, Edward. I think those are extremely insightful practical experiences. You brought out two very interesting points. One is the, for lack of a better word, the marriage of socioeconomics and technological sciences, and is essential for successful implementation. And also another very important point that we also highlight in the Frontier Data Study is the room to learn and grow. I mean, most often, many of these innovation projects are very short term, and we expect to see quick results. And innovations don't occur in quick successions. I mean, there's this balance between accounting and learning, accountability and learning. Even as an evaluator, we sometimes are the innovator's dilemma, right? Do we learn about it? Do we have the space to learn? Or do we just show that we've done something? So I'm glad that you brought out that FCDO recognizes that. In that context, I would like to just expand on your first point. In the study, we note the importance of the context and the culture and the ethical issues that surrounding some of these data sources. How do you cater to these issues? I mean, how do you deal with understanding the context in which a particular technology or a data source is deployed? And how do you engage the stakeholders? And how do you ensure that that union of two different disciplines that often work in silos are brought together? Can you suggest something to our listeners?
Sure. I mean, that is the heart of the challenge, because, you know, what we're talking about here is organizational reform, essentially. You can introduce a new technology with new capability, but I think what makes it really disruptive is when behavior changes as a result. The production model of your digital good or service has changed. And that sometimes creates a sense of winners and losers. People can feel threatened, especially when you're dealing with low capacity governments. There are not a lot of people in a GIS unit in the municipal government, they maybe have a precious job that they want to hold on to. And you come along with a new tool and say, hey, these, we can crowdsource this from the citizens. That can be very threatening. So there's a mind share that has to be built up. And the simplest solution is to let the data speak for themselves, but really act on real pain points where there is no tenable alternative. So we, you know, we didn't start by mapping the central business district of Dar es Salaam using, you know, crowdsourced youth labor, because Ministry of Lands and Survey and municipal governments, they have data. It's relatively well planned. But we focus on those areas where a municipal director has a sense of urgency to demarcate buildings and plots and quantify waste collection service, for example, where there is literally nothing on the map. So by going to the most underserved areas, the value of the data is self-evident often. We also have to kind of have these conversations about citizen data, crowdsourced data, open data, who's hosting it, who's approving it. And these questions have implicit sort of concerns about control, right? Who does this belong to and who gets to make the decisions is always in the back of the mind as you introduce a new model. So that's also why I think we need the ability to iterate. Because you demonstrate something perhaps tentatively, you do a pilot, you call it experimental, even if you're pretty confident it's going to work, what you're really doing is letting it sink in the mindset of the users on government that have to then internalize what it means for their work. Is this going to be a threat? Is this going to be an opportunity? And that requires many iterations. And unfortunately, in many bureaucratic sort of terms, changing a project is a bad word. It's called restructuring. And we like to sort of develop a five-year plan that never changes, and we stick to the plan throughout the 5 years. But in reality, when you're trying to change the operating model of the city and how things work, you need to be able to reframe frequently.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm keen to know, I'm sure our listeners are too, as well, to know about the work of Resilience Academy, especially on the building skill, local skills. That sounds very exciting to me. Could you walk us through briefly about what and how do you build skills?
So the Resilience Academy emerged in a sort of very evolutionary way out of the FCDO work. As we began to have more and more insight and, dare I say, success with some of these innovative data collection methods, we realized that the cause of building a local ecosystem of service providers, the skills, the capacity, was essential. And so Resilience Academy is a partnership with four Tanzanian universities, teaching the adoption of new digital tools. But the focus is not so much on high tech, but low cost, low complexity, locally available tech. So the camera and the GPS on the typical phone in the pocket of a bachelor's student of University of Dar es Salaam, for example. So how do we work with that kind of tool, as well as what's available openly on the internet for free? So there is, as you mentioned, I think a revolution in satellite monitoring, which becomes quite powerful when the data are open and you begin to apply image classifying algorithms, advances in AI image recognition. But this becomes really more important when you can then connect it to local labeling, ground truthing, other value-added activities. And we started quite frequently with community feedback, using youth to engage in informal areas and slums with local street leaders, household leaders, collecting information about services and about the condition of roads and drains and flooding and flood histories. So all manner of data relating to the built environment and to historical flood events that are not in an official government database, but we don't have very little characteristics. Developing the skill sets to go and digitize and populate those key data layers by using youth is a way of experimenting. If it doesn't work, we could say, well, it was a research project, it's no threat. But if it really does work, the data sets speak for themselves because they're immediately valuable. We're doing real world data collection campaigns and we're working with local government clients. So we're setting up, I mean, the universities to be partly data providers directly. And they do supply students in this program called the Placement in Industry, which is like a mass internship. So over the last 4 years, we've had the luxury of between 200 and 500 youth from four universities deployed on different digital data campaigns on behalf of the city. So this model is not just classroom learning of the tools, but it's real-world practicals developing data sets that are sort of foundational to more sophisticated urban planning needs. So I can give an example, two examples. One is the drainage condition survey. They mapped 200 kilometers of drains around the city, including every culvert, the little tunnels underneath roads, which sometimes are blocked completely. Sometimes they're filled with solid waste or just soil and vegetation, and they're overgrown. And it's the classic problem that a small municipal team of engineers will struggle to quickly map 20,000 culverts and 200 kilometers of drain and across the city. But it's amenable to a large number of students, 200, broken up into small groups, mapping their districts, their neighborhoods with a basic protocol, a handheld GPS that takes a geotagged picture, and some instructions on classifying drains, classifying culverts. They did the same with the soil map. There was no soil map of Dar es Salaam, which was an essential input to modeling the erosion and hence the sedimentation that the city is experiencing, and trying to assess the utility of a reforestation program and erosion control measures. So the first point is that, well, how, we can't model this without data.
Yeah.
An engineering company would charge a lot of money to bring engineers to come and then collect 700 samples around the city. But with 14 students, we can do that relatively quickly and cheaply. And they pick up the skills and they're available locally if there's a gap or if we want to replicate it. So Resilience Academy has been sort of proving ground for how to develop the workflows based on local people, local devices. Always a digital service. Every year it's a slightly different emphasis, but generally around some infrastructure or climate hazard need of the city.
Edward, that was fantastic. I really like your frugal innovation approach by using local resources, which builds capacity, keeps it cost effective, and eventually can be sustainable compared to hiring expensive consultants. And I think that's a great, great way to do it. And I hope we can get Resilience Academies around the world as well. Briefly now on your view on how Africa as a nation, or even Tanzania, uses drones or Earth observation data, mobile location data, and what's still missing and what needs to be done, if you can share some.
So I think drones present a huge leapfrogging opportunity because of the nature of the challenge they fit into, right? In the same way that urbanization in Africa, I mentioned it's some of the fastest unplanned growth, and this informal challenge requires a way that we innovate in the speed and responsiveness of our surveys. At the continental scale, even outside the cities, Africa has sort of two big deficits. The first is on local scale maps. It's about 3% map compared to over 90% in Europe, sort of high resolution local scale mapping. And that's essential for land administration and agriculture, digitizing crops, digitizing smallholder parcels, digitizing assets like roads, forestry. All of that is something that drones can accelerate on the survey and mapping side.
Thank you, Edward. That was useful. In one of our findings or conclusions, we found the challenge of capacity, as you rightly pointed out, to be a major challenge that still we have to overcome. But what from your awesome experience that you just described and your practical application, what are the opportunities and challenges for development practitioners, especially program managers in the FCDO, that can harness or overcome from your experience in utilizing, whether it's drone or Earth observation, or even expanding work that you're doing in Tanzania?
What are the opportunities? Well, I think, you know, we're in a really exciting digital revolution, the fourth industrial revolution, right? So there's no shortage of opportunities, but I think the right way to approach it is you know, leverage solutions that reduce cost and complexity. And it's the second part, complexity, that I think is what really helps scale. So just because there's a cool new product out there, you know, don't try to be tech driven. We say that a lot, and people, I think, do their best to avoid it. But sometimes sexy technology can be seductive. And I think where we're most effective is where we are really looking at that operating model and reducing complexity. And so that tends to bias towards sort of local, open, free where possible. And there's so much going on in that space where you can empower people with the tools they already have access to. They're just not quite aware how they can use them. I also think that there's a lot of interesting shifts in the sort of power dynamics when you begin to create data locally with this whole AI revolution. So we've been very excited about the potential of digital microworking. Microworking and microworking platforms are not new. Amazon, Mechanical Turk, Odesk, there's many different sort of historical precedents. But when it comes to development, we tend to think of sort of cash for works programs as a social safety net. We pay people to cut the grass and sweep the streets and keep the drains clean. And they're doing something useful in the community, and they're earning some cash as a sort of subsidence, stipend of some kind. But we don't do this in the digital economy. But we know there's many, many co-benefits to getting the unbanked into a sort of mobile money account, to having youth pick up digital skills or skill signaling. So I see opportunities where we can increasingly direct tasks to beneficiary communities more efficiently through micro-tasking. So I'll give you an example. In Kenya right now, we're preparing a sort of urban upgrading program in several cities. And there are routine data collection needs that we know are going to be there year after year after year. We don't intend to replace all the consultancy procurement plan at once, but we think a slice of that, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 30%, can be directed in terms of tiny tasks to have local residents report back on road condition surveys. Are the streetlights working? Where's the water kiosk? In the case of sort of COVID hotspot analysis, it's very important to know where are the public toilets and the water points, and is there soap and sanitizer, and are there public health warnings around? So, you know, monitoring that kind of messaging and compliance, for example. Own source revenue is a really critical one for local governments. They can't provide services if they can't collect taxes, but they can't collect taxes if they're not registering buildings and population and so forth. So a lot of this can be supported by micro-tasking that involves the local population that then learns about the gig economy, about the digital service provision, about the use cases of that data, and can lead to other skills in private tasking. So we ran a pilot with Google that's launched a platform called Taskmate. And we ran actually 7 pilots, so multiple, many different platforms. But in the case of Google, they had private users, Google as a user, World Bank as a user, other NGOs. And we were surprised to see just what a large volume of millions of tasks can be generated relatively quickly. And I think governments and development projects can begin to act a little bit as market makers in directing some of that demand in a digital way to their beneficiary communities. So I see this as sort of the beginning of an interesting space, rethinking what sort of safety nets might look like, rethinking about how do we connect the informal gig economy to the formal economy, what kind of provisions are needed. Obviously, we want to avoid exploitation. We want to provide equal access to opportunity. There are inequalities in terms of digital access and digital literacy. So it's by no means straightforward, but the challenges are not technical. The challenges really, as I say, organizational. And I think that that's quite exciting opportunity.
Thank you, Edward. That was quite comprehensive. I mean, you do such cool work that I can keep talking to you, but we have to really keep this short so our listeners can listen in. But I just have a last question for you. How can we partner with you, or how can the listeners who are interested in this space partner with you, and who can partner with you?
Well, many of the projects I've spoken about are themselves partnerships, right? So I work for the World Bank, and you know, we respond to government client requests. And if you're a donor, please talk to me directly, and we're happy to discuss how we can scale up programs. As you mentioned, it would be great to see Resilience Academy in every country. That's something we're hoping to try and do. There's a number of public good pieces to that, and then there's a number of services that should be bottom-up, demand-based. So we're actively looking for partners and donors, but it's not just about money. It's, I think, technical partnership. So we do have universities in Europe and institutes that are collaborating with the Resilience Academy, providing in-kind tools, training, coursework, peer reviewing, doing student exchanges. So Delft University has a number of master's students that are using Tanzanian data and working in teams with Tanzanian students on the research and innovation agenda. In Zanzibar, the drone imagery was released as open data by the government, and that led to a lot of interest from AI communities to do an AI challenge on image recognition calibrated for Zanzibari buildings. So, you know, we in Africa may not have a lot of money to contract partners, but we have scarce data sets that we're producing that I think have a lot of value. If you're interested in really high resolution drone imagery, you know, we can talk about these kinds of partnerships as well. And it's not just drone, but street view imagery, labeling and tagging and ground truthing satellite services. These are all activities that I think are ripe for collaboration. So if you're a university or a tech company and you've got a cool product, do reach out, but probably it wouldn't be a partnership with World Bank. It would be connecting to one of the university members or startups.
Edward, it's been a real pleasure. I mean, I've always believed development work is not a 9-to-5 job. It's a calling. And true to your job title, you gave us excellent presentation on both the technology perspective, the resilience, and the human and organizational challenges. And we hope to continue having this dialogue with you and your team. And for listeners, I hope Edward's talk was especially useful to you in getting your interest on utilizing these emerging data sources. And also, if you're from FCDO, hope you are able to connect with Edward and his team. And if you're already doing that, it has given you enough impetus to continue expanding the work and also learning from it. Edward, again, once again, thank you so much for joining us from Tanzania and sharing all your great work. And we hope to continue to engage with you again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Val.
Dear listeners, thanks again for listening to this episode of the Data Frontier podcast. If you wish to learn more about the work of our guests, please check out the links in the description. I would also encourage you to check out the full Frontier Data Study, which can also be found in the link below. This podcast is funded by the FCDO, and I would like to thank Matthew McConaughey, the podcast content lead, and many thanks to our producers, Ben Walker and David Vigoro. Please do check out our other episodes in this podcast series and get in touch with us if you wish to learn more or partner up on any projects. Contact information to reach us is also in the description. Thanks so much for listening and have a great evening or day wherever in the part of the world that you're joining us from. Thank you.